And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Wednesday, April 3rd. 31 degrees and sunshine here in Old Town Park City. Heber City also reporting 31 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Giboy. Good morning.
Leslie, happy Wednesday to you. We're halfway through the week, and as of right now, we are currently climbing up on the Utah spring weather roller coaster, and we are going to be treated to a beautiful day today. We'll see mostly sunny skies with a daytime high that comes in the middle 50s in Park City. I think we'll end up right around 54 degrees. And for perspective, the average high today in Park City is 48. So it'll be more than 5 degrees above our seasonal average for today. While in Heber, we could easily get into the low 60s. So if you enjoy mild temperatures and sunshine, today is the day to get outside and enjoy it, a picture-perfect Chamber of Commerce weather day. Then into tonight, it's mostly clear skies, and it will be chilly. It just won't be too cold for this time of year because the average low for this time of year is in the upper 20s, but will only drop to around 35 degrees in Park City, and it might just be a fraction cooler down in the Heber Valley. Then on Thursday, that's when we're going to get to the top of the roller coaster with a daytime high that could sneak into the upper 50s in Park City. But as of right now, we'll go with the daytime high of 57. During the first half of the day, we'll mainly check in with mostly sunny skies. But throughout the day, you'll start to notice increasing clouds and increasing winds, because by tomorrow, the high pressure that's keeping our weather quiet now will be moving away to the east, and a low pressure will be approaching from the west. And that's ultimately going to lead to the coming down back on the roller coaster as we go from Friday into Saturday. On Friday, as that system works its way in, we'll see an increasing chance of wet weather. It looks like that best chance of wet weather is going to come during the second half of the day, even though there will be a slight chance early on. So early in the day, if we see any wet weather, mainly going to be snow. And then during the heart of the day, before the cold front moves in, we could see rain and snow in Park City with the daytime high that'll come down to 49 degrees, which again is very seasonal for this time of year. But we might only be at 9 degrees briefly, because as we go from Friday night into Saturday morning, that overnight low will drop to 24 degrees with an 80% chance of seeing snow. And then we'll see the wraparound snow showers on Saturday with a 90% chance. And by Saturday, we only might see a daytime high around freezing. And we could be looking at some accumulations in the magnitude of maybe 2 to 4 inches, but we'll fine tune those numbers as we get a little bit closer. A trailing system will lead to a continued chance of seeing some spotty snow showers at least into Sunday. But by early next week, it looks like northern Utah might begin to calm down, even though we can't rule out a slight chance maybe through at least Monday. But at least from Sunday into early next week, even as we hold on to some slightly unsettled weather, our temperatures will begin to climb. We'll only be in the middle 30s on Sunday, but we should be back in the low 40s by Monday. And then we'll be looking at a mostly sunny sky day on Tuesday with a daytime high back to that near seasonal average in the upper 40s, Leslie.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Drew Hardesty. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Overnight lows, and I put that with quotation marks around it, are about 10 to 15 degrees warmer than about this time yesterday. And so what that means is that window for being on or beneath steep solar aspects will be both narrow and fleeting for today. So as always, the ticket is early starts and get off of that terrain before things become wet, unconsolidated, and unsupportable and dangerous. The danger will rise rapidly to considerable on all steep solar aspects. That's east to south to west. And with temperatures rising to even the low 50s at sort of the lower elevations of the mountains, and probably the mid 30s, maybe mid upper 30s at the higher elevations, that's even going to impact some of the low and middle elevation shady aspects. So certainly watch out situation for wet avalanches today. That's only going to get worse tomorrow as the temperatures will have a really poor refreeze overnight tonight, and then even more sweltering temperatures ahead of the cold front for tomorrow and into early Friday morning. So get up early and off of that terrain, and get back to the house before things become too wet and unstable.
Okay. All right, Drew, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dye is previewing this week's City Council meeting. And finally, the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadel, will be joined by Gardens Director Melissa Solstice with a look ahead at this year's growing season. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include award-winning adventure journalist Will Cockrell, who discusses Everest Incorporated, the renegades and rogues who built an industry at the top of the world. Then cognitive scientist Andy Norman discusses a new approach to our world's misinformation problem, centered on the idea that our minds have immune systems, and it's an involved mechanism for spotting and shedding problematic information. All of that coming up this morning from 9 to 10. Taking a look at some local news now, some Utahns are working to raise the legal standard for consent to ensure sexual assault offenders can be held accountable. KPCW's Connor Thomas has this report, and there is a warning. The story does discuss sexual violence, so please listen with care.
Family law attorney Taryn Evans says Utah law makes it more difficult to prosecute and convict rapists. Evans survived a sexual assault in 2019, and 1 month ago, her attacker pleaded guilty to misdemeanor sexual battery and did not have to register as a sex offender.
Instead of taking the case to trial, the prosecutors were worried about the way the consent law is written, and they gave a plea deal to my rapist.
And those prosecutors' worries are shared by others around the state. According to the state health department, 3 out of every 4 sexual assaults in Utah go unreported. Despite that, the state exceeds the national average for rapes per capita, and the numbers show criminal convictions are rare. University of Utah nursing professor Dr. Julie Valentine collected data from Wasatch Front sexual assault cases over the previous decade. It showed about 1 in 10 ended in conviction, whether by trial or plea deal. And in all of those cases, survivors submitted sexual assault kits. Utah law states consent is absent if, quote, the victim expresses a lack of consent through words or conduct, end quote, or if the person is impaired in some way and the perpetrator knows it. That makes consent the absence of a no. Evans and others, like State Representative Angela Romero, say it should instead be the presence of a yes.
In many situations, a person freezes, so they don't say yes, they don't say no. But they still don't give consent.
Romero first introduced a bill legislating affirmative consent in 2019 and has twice since, including in the 2024 general session. It didn't get out of committee this year by a 6-5 vote. But conversation around the issue is growing. In the month since her attacker's plea deal, Evans has been reaching out to other advocates and attorneys. That includes Summit County attorney Margaret Olson, who says she's currently screening a sexual assault case that will be a challenge to prosecute as rape because of Utah's consent law.
It's extremely frustrating, not just from a legal perspective, but from the perspective of having to sit across a table and talk to a sexual assault survivor and explain this law. It needs to be fixed.
Romero's working with stakeholders like Evans and hopes movement can be made during the legislature's monthly interim meetings. She expects to introduce the bill again, but after working on the 2017 law that made it mandatory to test all rape kits, she knows change takes time.
And so this is a normal process when you're talking about legislation, and we want to make sure we do it right. But more importantly, we need to think about those survivors of sexual assault who feel like they haven't gotten justice. And they've done everything they should. They reported it to police. They did their sexual assault kit. They did everything they were supposed to.
Evans says critics of the legislation say continuously asking for consent is unrealistic.
When you compare that with the damage of what's happening now, where victims are not protected and they're being raped and sexually assaulted, that harm is much worse than some inconvenience factor of having to, assess consent each step of the way, which is what I believe most people do anyway.
The bill Romero has proposed states consent can be expressed through either words or actions. It isn't about having people sign a contract before sex, Evans says. It's about making sure what happened to her doesn't happen again to anyone else. Resources are available for survivors of sexual violence in the Wasatch Back. Numbers for the Peace House and the Sexual Assault Hotline are available at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, on the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Offices, I have Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so at long last, you have received an application from Henry Sieg. This was a project contemplated years ago, but it did require a new zone to be developed, the neighborhood mixed use. So is that his plan, is to come in for a rezone, or is he going to keep it community commercial?
Excellently phrased question. The answer is His proposal is a combination of both. So for the listeners out there who may not be familiar exactly where this project is we're talking about, it's a 15-acre piece of property out at the Silver Summit Interchange area, directly across the U.S. frontage road from Home Depot. The property's currently all, I think it's like 14.75 acres, a little shy of 15. The entire property is zoned community commercial. What Mr. Sigg is proposing to do is to rezone a portion of that property, I think the number is 8 acres, to neighborhood mixed use. That would allow both commercial, residential, civic uses. What his plan includes is across the entire site, 123,000 square feet of grocery store, retail, restaurant. The grocery store portion of that would be located on the existing CC community zone portion of the property. In addition to the store and the retail and the restaurants, what's being proposed is 409 residential units. 235 of those would be deed-restricted workforce housing units. 174 of those would be market units. The exact configuration unit sizes of those are still being worked on to a certain extent. The plan for both the commercial and the residential would be parked by sort of a program of both structured underbuilding parking and surface parking. I think the current tally on parking in that's around 750 spaces. He's proposing two small, what is being described as micro transit stop transit centers. Those would be an enclosed structure, restroom facilities for that. Strategy of some public spaces out there. You're correct. This has been in the works now for a number of years. Years ago, the planning staff here had been working on an implementing strategy for the Basin General Plan that sort of identified some potential mixed-use areas. This is one of those potential mixed-use areas. We created a neighborhood mixed-use zone draft. Mr. Sigg had his project on the drawing board. He elected to actually propose and move that zone forward. The zone was eventually adopted by both, recommended by the Planning Commission and adopted by the Council. So this is really the very first test. Now, the Commission looked at it last Tuesday, very high-level review of that. I think what they were looking at is just on its face, did the plan check the necessary boxes in order to move forward, the location, the mix of uses, both the residential, the commercial, the potential civic. And I think what came out of that meeting was a green light to take the next step forward. And what that would entail would be Mr. Sigg going and providing, I think, more specific detail on the massing of some of those buildings, the unit mix, the circulation within the area. So I don't know if we're going to see this back here in the next couple weeks, but it's something that will be moving forward later into the spring and summer.
Okay, I wanted to, looking at the iterations that we have seen over the years, at some point we were looking at like 98,000 square feet of retail plus a 62,000 square foot grocery store. In 2023, we saw 150,000 square feet about retail and another 62,000 square feet for the grocery store. Are you telling me now that the 123,000 includes that 60,000 square foot grocery store?
Yeah, the 123,000 is the overall commercial number. Now, in terms of the size of that store, I think I would be fair in saying that that is still a detail that is to be worked out first from Mr. Sigg and then to be reviewed by the Planning Commission. I think the size of the store that was being discussed last Tuesday was more in the 40,000 square foot range.
Okay. And then at some point, both iterations before this included a small hotel. Is that still in the mix?
Undetermined at this point in time. I think what we're looking at right now are the number of doors, and that would equate to parking and sort of traffic and transportation considerations right now.
And what about this amphitheater that was originally proposed?
Again, I think that's an amenity package that hasn't been finalized, so no decisions on that at this point. But, you know, there was a bit of discussion on the need for both, you know, community space, public space, and connectivity, because as we saw, we've always been, you know, we've recognized the fact that this particular neighborhood, that exit 2 out at Silver Summit, with, you know, an already existing promontory community out there and a Silver Creek Village community out there, and, you know, the destiny of the Florence Gilmore property that the county owns is still, you know, to be determined in the future. That is going to be an area, a very big neighborhood with, you know, a number of full-time residents living in that, and full-time residents communities need those gathering spaces. So I think that's an important element on the commission's mind for that project out there.
Okay, is it still being called the Marketplace Commons?
Yep, I think that's still the name that's being used to label this one.
Okay, what do you see the hurdles as that Henry's facing?
Probably among the, I wouldn't say hurdles, but key discussion points are going to ultimately be what that residential unit mix is and how they're configured. I mean, we're encouraged by the proposal for the workforce housing component of that. The traffic and circulation through that area is going to be critical. For those who pass through or live in that neighborhood, you realize that there's a tremendous amount of vehicle movement through both the interchange and that part of the east side of 40, both with the build out of Silver Creek Village and Promontory. Right now, I think we're scheduled this spring to see the construction of the first of probably several roundabout improvements. The first one will happen at the southbound interchange. You know, when you get off US 40, we're currently, our engineering and public works folks are in design for a redo of the existing traffic circle that's out in front of Home Depot and Burt Brothers and the gas station out there. So the timing of this project coming on board with the construction of those roundabouts are going to be critical. I think that as a neighborhood mixed use, or portions of the property being zoned neighborhood mixed use, it's going to allow for some building massing above the traditional 32-foot height limit. And so we're being looking at that, see how that fits into the neighborhood. So I think that there was generally an openness on the Planning Commission. I think what is a potential benefit of this, and I want to be careful, you know, if there's a benefit to this, we for a long time have been working on a strategy to identify the existing and growing neighborhoods and seeing if there is a way, if we're smart, to insert some neighborhood service commercial uses like grocery stores and some of those satellite retails in order to capture trips that would want to take their business all the way out, you know, driving through Highland Estates and adding to the traffic that's in Kimball Junction. This could potentially help that, but I think, you know, there's a number of steps that we want to kind of methodically get to before there's a decision by the Planning Commission. But I think it's something that's going to be in front of them frequently as we get to the late spring and into the summer.
Okay. Real quick, April 18th work session on Cedar Crest. Just a heads up that this is going to be before the Planning Commission, the Eastside Planning Commission.
Yeah, so I appreciate you asking about that. It's a work session, so no public comment will be taken, but I think it's really important for the public to be involved. If folks can attend live at the Legis building, it's gonna be at 6 o'clock. If you can't, please attend remotely. I describe this from the public's perspective as a great opportunity to take some really important notes, because what the Planning Commission is going to spend the evening doing is taking a look at the project in its entirety, but more importantly, the potential ordinance that would set forth how that area, if a project was approved, how it would be built out. You know, it would describe, you know, what's being labeled as the community structure plan. Think of that as the zoning map. It identifies as the uses, the range of densities, you know, how it's clustered, where those open space and ag areas are. It describes how a project in those specific neighborhood areas would go through the process. You know, it sets forth HOA design review process, similar to the Canyons, not dissimilar to Silver Creek Village. It would talk about those submittal requirements. It would talk about how the transportation and the infrastructure would be reviewed, what those threshold requirements would be. The 18th is also going to be picking back up on the housing discussion. You know, the village overlay zone in our Eastern Summit County code requires a mix of housing types and affordabilities. That's bringing up the discussion of, you know, community housing or workforce housing. Right now, what's been discussed by the applicant in front of the commission is a mix of strategies, you know, deed restricted units, accessory dwelling units, smaller units, self-help units. No, still a work in progress. No decision by the Planning Commission on that. I note that the applicants have worked with Zions Public Financing to do a housing report. There's a draft of it out there. We haven't gotten a copy of that yet. That's in its final edits, but I think this is going to be available for both the staff, the public, and the commission to review and weigh in. Because of a series of public hearings, and those are important, you know, for the commission to hear, you know, the comments and the concerns of the neighborhood. By the time we take all that input, it always seems that the night grows late, and there isn't just sufficient time to go deep into those discussions. That's what the 18th's about. We don't have a public hearing specifically scheduled yet, and that's for a reason. You know, coming out of the 18th's meeting, there may be more detail and information that the commission wants to, you know, see in a work session, you know, level. So we want to make sure that we cover all those bases, but I want to assure everyone that when that next public hearing date is determined, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that everybody's aware of that. We'll put the reader boards out in the Colville-Hoytesville area so everybody can attend.
Okay, I got to leave it there, Pat. Thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thanks a lot, Leslie. Have a good week.
That's Summit County Community Development Director Pat Putt. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, real quick, Wasatch County Republican delegates gathered last night for the GOP convention where they voted on county nominees and heard from state and federal candidates. Two county council seats and the county assessor had multiple Republicans run in the running. The candidates needed votes from 60% of the county's 232 delegates to receive the party nomination, or in the case of one regional county council, 60% of that region's delegates. For the county council's Western Heber seat, incumbent Kendall Crittenton received 70% of the votes over competitor Mary Williams. He'll be the Republican nominee in November's general election. For the county council at-large seat, Melvin McCrory, Colleen Bonner, and Nick Lopez were in contention. Bonner and Lopez emerged as the top two. Neither reached the 60% threshold in a runoff, triggering a primary. The same was true for the county assessor's race, in which Bob Adams and incumbent Todd Griffin were facing off. Both will appear on the primary ballot. primary election will be held June 25th to determine the final Republican candidates for November's ballots. And Summit County Republicans also convened last night to hear from local, state, and national candidates. No votes were taken. Just two Republicans are running for the county elected positions, Tori Welch for Summit County Council Seat A and Ari Ioannidis for Council Seat C. Both men made speeches. Welch, a businessman and state committee rep for county Republicans, emphasized the quality of life in Summit County. He faces incumbent Democrat Roger Armstrong. Ioannidis, the treasurer for North Summit Fire District, emphasized the need to put a Republican voice on the currently all-Democratic council. Ioannidis will face either housing advocate Megan McKenna or Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook in November. A primary vote June 25th again will decide which Democrat advances to the general election. The Park City Council meets Thursday in work session starting at 4 o'clock. In the studio with a preview, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. So the only work session item is the potential City Hall remodel, the last one I think happening in 2009. That was after KPCW had moved out. So what's this remodel going to entail if it happens?
Well, it's something we started discussing about a year and a half ago. Coming out of COVID, as everyone knows, there's sort of an explosive amount of growth for public and municipal services, and that runs the gamut from permits being pulled to inspections to financial aspects, planning department, and otherwise. And so City Hall, for lack of a better term, has just been running out of room. Now, we were very proactive coming out of the pandemic about creating shared workspaces, more condominiumizing, so maybe it's a bad word, but internal aspects of the building where we were cycling multiple people through the same workstations throughout the day. But we've really been sort of busting at the seams, and lately it's also been impacting some of our customer service. And so the last time we had a comprehensive renovation, as you mentioned, was 2009. And last year we tried to sock away almost $1 million to begin building a balance to potentially renovate the inside of City Hall. The focus would primarily be sort of the main floor, which is the thrust of where most of the customer service interactions occur through building, planning, engineering, business licensing, our finance division, really perhaps converting that area to this true one-stop shop. In 2009, there was an effort to put all of those divisions on the same floor, but what it still would result in is sort of window shopping. So if you came in there today and you're pulling a permit and you required multiple divisions to review your permit or sign off, you know, by and large, you sort of get ping pong back and forth between the windows. And that's something that we can easily perhaps prevent through a renovation of that floor and creating individuals that can really sign off on multiple permits at any time and have cross-departmental training. Our hope is it would break down some of the silos between the divisions, but it's a little bit of both. It would be an operational adjustment and a capital adjustment. However, City Hall is this iconic building, and it's historic. It's incredibly complicated. They did about a $9 million renovation back in 2009. We don't contemplate anything of that magnitude, but if we are running out of space and it's impacting customer service, it's something we need to start thinking about.
Well, I was going to say, if it's too crowded, why not look at a new location? Again, we've talked about this. You know, you're bringing in 100-plus employees that just add to the traffic problems coming into town. You take up a bunch of parking there at China Bridge. Why not look at some of your other property there, maybe at Gordo or Quinn's Junction?
I think that's a fine point, and I believe that's the reason that we haven't put our finger on anything yet. We've begun to build a balance. We know that we are running out of space up there. We either need to amend that space, as I suggested, or perhaps we need to look at other alternatives. But that's a very delicate public policy decision. I've seen and read and discussed with other managers in other cities and towns about moving city halls, building a new city hall, even renovating your existing city halls, whether they need to stay in the downtown core. Of course, there are impacts of staying in the downtown core, but there's also a sense of community and character and legacy about when people are working for your community, but having them in the community, in the heart of it. There's an argument to be made if they've got to travel in and out and use our buses and our recreation services, they're perhaps going to be more attached and they're going to care about this place more and have a higher level of performance and morale. So There's a significant amount of considerations. We are just getting this up and underway.
All right. So are we talking about starting anything this year? No, we're just going to, whether or not we put another $1 million in the fund.
I think initially that would be the target. But I think, you know, to be fair, we're probably going to have a couple sensitive policy conversations about, is this the right location? Do we really have the space? But no matter what, we're going to have to start building a balance.
All right. During the regular meeting, a discussion about a resolution recognizing the Zero Food Waste 2030 Compact. Is this what, just a statement of support for the efforts of the Park City Community Foundation's efforts?
Well, I think it's really a partnership between the Community Foundation, Summit County, and Park City Municipal. We have experience of setting sort of lofty goals out in the future, as this one would be. We currently know that food waste, last I read, is almost 40% of the material going into the landfills in Summit County, and that's something that we can easily divert portions of. And so I'm saying it's something that we're working together on. We're going to set this lofty goal out in the future, but there are going to be a myriad of, I would hope, sort of vertically integrated programs about working with restaurants and businesses, big and small businesses, residential households, to see if collaboratively we can divert more of this waste that other cities and towns, quite frankly, do across the country. I think you and I were on a city tour in Boise together. They have a very robust program, but there's a myriad of communities that do this across North America with a lot of success.
All right. Also, another discussion with regard to water fees. According to Public Utilities Director Clint McAfee, water rate increases are needed to continue to offset increased costs from inflation. However, the council did request a third-party water rate study before further consideration of increasing rates as part of next year's budget. You did hire a third party, so when are you going to have those results?
We hope actually later this spring. Bowens and Collins is already working on the study. To be fair, you know, our water department has been incredibly proactive over the years. You and I have had multiple conversations about, you know, why water rates are continuing to increase. I would like to say, fortunately, we have had a pattern of sort of nominal increases year over year, which have prevented some of the things that are happening around the state. I was discussing with the public utilities director the other day, you know, down in the valley, there are districts increasing 30% a year this year, or the next 2 years, or 25%. And our public utilities department had been doing twos and threes for a long time in the hopes of, you know, sort of avoiding those large increases. However, they are still increases nonetheless. And I think the mayor and council wanted to be incredibly deliberate, because we have made fundamental changes to our water model and our rate structure over the last 4 to 5 years, primarily in the name of equity between kind of classes of users and different groups of users, and sustainability. And as these things shake out, I believe the mayor and council just really want to make sure they have a third set of eyes on that model, understanding the impacts intended and unintended before contemplating what is potentially a 10% increase this year. So we've been very deliberate. We're working with a third party, and our hope is to have some quality information this spring.
That's the proposal, a 10% increase?
Potentially. And I think, to be fair, you know, that was one of the aspects that sort of triggered the, while this may be necessary, because as you know, our water division is an enterprise fund, so they need to raise the funds that it costs to do the capital projects and pay the people that show up at 2 o'clock in the morning when there's a water line break, and manage our systems and our pumps and technologies. We have an obligation to have a balanced fund. That's what they were projecting, and so council said, can we just step back and take a quick look at this?
Okay. Discussion with regard to microtransit. What we have heard from High Valley Transit is that the contract with Park City for microtransit ends April 28th. So is that the end of it?
I don't know, actually. I think that's the public policy decision that we're wrestling with and we're toiling with. For a little bit of a history lesson in our community, we've constantly been balancing what type of transit services to provide and to whom, how frequent, how often, and what locations. And, although transit is free to the rider, transit isn't free. It's an incredibly expensive and complicated enterprise that the municipality runs and Summit County runs. We have tried over years to try to figure out this last mile or ensure that everyone in our community, no matter where they live, would have access to transit. and trying to make a determination about whether or not that's even possible and whether that's financially feasible and whether there's enough return on investment and use. And so we piloted a microtransit program citywide for the better part of a year. We've also put out a request for proposals looking ahead. But my estimation is the mayor and council have an extremely difficult public policy decision to make. We've tested something. We understand how it works. We understand who's using it and sort of who's not using it. But it's very expensive. And if it's something we're going to continue moving forward, we need to be really careful.
Yeah. So what's the status, though? I mean, residents just aren't using it?
I think it depends, largely. A lot of it depends on the land use in the area, and that's a jargony term, but it depends on the density and the type of topography, where people are living and what they're trying to do. So one estimate that we have is that the land use in the county, perhaps, or the basin, may be more suitable for the microtransit service than it is, let's say, in Park City, where someone is sort of intentionally living at a higher elevation, has a really long driveway, and perhaps really never contemplated or never will use public transportation. And that doesn't mean that they don't believe in it. It doesn't mean that they're not helping support it through their taxes and otherwise. But they may have just come here for a lifestyle that doesn't or isn't suitable for public transit. That being said, there's a neighbor next door that says, I have just as much right to public transit as anyone else, and it should come right in front of my house. So here goes the balancing act of this complicated public policy decision about how much service to provide and where and at what cost and what's the return on investment for the community.
So I think I read in the staff report, though, that setting up fixed routes with perhaps smaller buses in some of those outlying areas like Royal Street, Upper Park Meadows, Quinns Junction would actually be cheaper than the contract that you're paying?
It may. Now, so we would be limiting services in other areas, and you've mentioned a few that we would be trying to augment or be flexible and creative about providing some mainframe level of service in these areas, not quite microtransit, probably less frequent than regular frequent transit. But our folks are trying to be creative. They're trying to be innovative. They know that people in these areas in particular probably were using some semblance of the microtransit program. And because of perhaps their use or their reliance, they're providing an alternative for our policymakers to consider. And you've hit the nail on the head that perhaps it would be a little bit cheaper. However, it required different types of equipment and probably slower routes than people are familiar with and not the same on-demand service as the microtransit has provided. But so I just want to congratulate our folks and thank them for being creative. And then I also know a lot of work went into this pilot program. And so when the mayor and council, you know, have the ability to rely on our professionals and High Valley Transit and via the existing provider to say, hey, can you implement something? Let's try it out and let's test it. An incredible amount of work went into this. So I think the people that have been involved and, you know, people are on pins and needles. They're not really sure where this is going to go.
All right. Council will also get a look at the DoubleTree redevelopment and mitigation plan. Why is it coming to City Council? It hasn't even been to Planning Commission yet.
Well, I didn't mean to laugh, but I chuckled because I had the same reaction, and I asked our housing division, and their response is this is actually not that uncommon of an occurrence where an applicant who is processing an application for a development before the Planning Commission will at a certain point also seek information and feedback and deliberations on their affordable housing plan. And so, you know, an applicant has every right to request this review. That's what they've done here. To be fair, our agendas have been very busy over the last couple of weeks, and so we've actually put them off a couple times, I believe. But given the agenda, there was no reason we could really put them off before. They've made this request. But to be fair, you know, we have at least two former planning commissioners on our council and the mayor and council member Dickey. And in particular, this group's been very deferential to the Planning Commission thus far about, you know, no even appearance of getting out in front of them or making a decision that would somehow impact the decisions that they would need to make. And so I don't know where this is gonna go. It may be just sort of the first deliberation where they can vet some of the ideas. I'm not privy to if this is gonna be an up or down decision tomorrow evening.
Okay, and I guess what's really changed is that I remember seeing one plan that it kept the hotel and then it would build some affordable housing or other uses on top. What we're talking about here is basically another housing development. I mean, it sounds like the hotel's gone and away, going away.
You have better specifics than I do on the revised plan, so I just shouldn't wing it on the radio. If you don't mind, you have better information than I do.
Okay. What it showed was market rate condominiums along with about 52 affordable rental units. Real quick, Park Meadows Country Club wants the city to waive an affordable housing requirement that is generated by expanding its maintenance building. I guess so a new MPD triggers a housing obligation of some sort?
My belief is it's an amendment to the MPD. I could be incorrect there, but we are told, and the report indicates, that this is largely area that's been used for the last, I don't know, 40 years or so. A lot of it is disturbed already, and in gravel or other things where they're storing equipment. And other elements for the golf course, sort of back of the house amenities, and they're seeking to enclose some of these. And obviously when you're building and under an MPD, there's an affordable housing requirement. It's a little bit complicated because the zone actually doesn't even allow housing. I believe it's a recreation use zone, so it doesn't even allow them to build housing here. So they're seeking a waiver. I think our team evaluated it, and it's a difficult decision. I think on the one hand, this isn't a new use. This isn't driving new employees. This isn't creating more demand. It's actually just enclosing existing equipment in an area that's already disturbed. At the same time, our team is trying really hard to produce new units of affordable housing. And so again, there's a balancing act in here, and our council's going to have to deliberate over this waiver request publicly and transparently and make a tough decision.
Okay, and as we've been reporting, housing manager Jason Glidden is moving on to take on the executive director role for Mountainlands Community Housing. So will you be replacing him, or?
I believe, you know, to some extent, every time someone departs from the municipality, there's always an opportunity to sort of take a step back and evaluate what we need, what are the council goals, what is the community asking for, are we being efficient, is there other ways to deploy resources? So conventional wisdom is Jason was a very high performer and really took our housing initiatives to new heights. He was under an incredible amount of stress and scrutiny and really delivered some really important projects on Park Avenue, down in Prospector, and then in particular at the Engine House and sort of the Bonanza area. But we'll take a contemplative moment here to evaluate our needs before we just throw the lure back in the water and recruit a new director. We're going to make sure that it aligns with what council's priorities are.
Okay, and then in terms of your prospects for your new senior planner, is that happening?
We are currently interviewing for that position, and I'm told that we had a round of interviews last Thursday or Friday, 5 or 6 applicants. So I hope to have a quality update there in the future.
All right, and any word about your new Park City leadership director?
Also still recruiting. It sounds like everyone's leaving. That is not the case, but we've had an incredible amount of stability. I was just talking with someone about this over the last couple of years, particularly post-COVID. I don't know if the post-COVID era sort of had people hunker down and stay in place, but we actually fared incredibly well coming out of COVID with a really tight-knit team, a lot of continuity and stability. So maybe we're entering a little bit of an inflection period where the economy is changing, the dynamics have changed, and we're gonna have some people that have built skill sets and are seeking perhaps new opportunities and otherwise. So we still have a very tight-knit team. You know, we're working hard to replace these individuals that are leaving our team with new individuals. We're gonna have new ideas and new skill sets. And we're excited about it. We're sorry to see our colleagues leave, and we thank them for their contributions.
Okay, Matt, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
Well, spring's here, and that means that garden season just around the corner. In the studio with an update from Summit Community Gardens and Eats, I have Executive Director Helen Nadel, along with Garden Director Melissa Stoles. Good morning.
Good morning. Great
Hi,
to
Leslie.
Be here.
Okay, so Ellen, we'll start with you and just give us a recap. What's happening at the garden? I mean, snow's melted.
The snow is not quite melted, but we're getting there. It's really exciting to see spring taking shape, and Melissa has a lot to say about what is going on and what's going to be going on in the garden.
Okay, you got a number of community education programs happening, Melissa?
Yeah, we do. We have a bunch of classes coming up actually next week. So the first one will be High Altitude 101 plus Garden Planning. So this is going to be a great class for all sorts of different folks, from newbies to folks that have been gardening for years. I think everyone can have a takeaway from it. So we'll go over lots of different things, from selecting seeds for our high altitude climate, what's going to grow best. I know you and I talk about tomatoes a lot, and I feel like that's something everyone loves to grow. So we can figure out which seeds are going to be the best for our climate here. But we're going to talk about lots of different things like companion planting, crop rotation, and just kind of understanding how to go about it here in Park City.
Okay, what other classes have you got planned?
Yeah, after that, we'll do a seed starting class. So that's going to be a partnership with USU, and Wesley Crump is going to be helping me out with that. So Wes and I are going to do an in-person seed starting class at Swanner. And the dates for that are 4 and 18. So that's going to be a Friday evening. So a fun Friday evening event. So it'll be an hour and a half. And Wes and I will take you through all the 101s of seed starting and soil. And you'll walk away with a tray of seeds for your garden.
Okay, and yeah. Then it sounds like he's also going to do a class on growing fruit trees.
Yeah, so if you're not familiar with the garden, we do have a small orchard that our wonderful local Rotary has helped us with. And so Wes is going to come in and just show folks the 101 on pruning trees, how to take care of them, and just, our first outdoor class in the garden, so that'll be exciting.
Okay, registration all done online?
Exactly, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be on Saturday the 20th at Fruit Tree Class. Great.
All right. You also have registration ongoing for your summer camps.
Summer camps are hot item right now. We are really excited about how many young people and families have already signed up. There are still some camps available, especially there's culinary arts in the garden, garden creations, and garden arts and culture. So a lot of focus on art and on cooking in those weeks. But every single week of camp really includes gardening, fun activities, yoga, lots of special guests, cooking, and art. So all of that is included. There's just a little special focus every week. One thing that we're really excited about this year, Leslie, is the dramatic increase in scholarships that we've offered. So last year, we were able to give about 22 scholarships to kids in our community to be able to have access to camp. This year, we have already given 48 scholarships, so more than doubling our scholarship program. So important for all young people to have access to amazing outdoor fun hands-on opportunities. We know that there are lots of people in our community. We've already, for those scholarships, we have, everybody from our workforce to teachers to nonprofit friends around the community who are signed up for those scholarships. So want to just throw out there that we would love to be able to provide more scholarships for more people in our community. If you are inspired to do that, we are inviting you to go to our website. $75 provides camp for one child for a day, and $375 provides camp for a week. And we would love to be able to provide more scholarships to folks in our community.
Okay, it sounds like you also have a few more spots in the After School in the Garden program that starts soon.
That's right, yeah, that is starting in just a couple of weeks. And in particular, either the Friday, signing up for Fridays, everybody could use a little help. That's a wonderful day where we have early release. So please go onto our website. You can still sign up for After School in the Garden on Fridays. I think we also have some of our kind of flexible passes available. So that's 6 classes anytime you'd like. So come on in. It is so much fun to start planting in the garden and get things started for the rest of the season with our young people.
Okay. You're also got another event happening with La Milpa celebration. This is going to happen next month, though.
Yeah, so we are thrilled to once again, this is the third year in a row that we are partnering with Artes de Mexico in Utah, which is an amazing organization that provides all kinds of arts programming, from culinary arts to cultural arts to visual arts. And the La Milpa program really highlights the cultural contribution to agriculture, the cultural knowledge that exists in the Mayan community, really from 2,000 years ago to the present day. Those workshops are incredibly fun, delicious ways to highlight the contributions in our community of so many in the Latinx community. And we are thrilled. There's going to be, I can't quite release the exact date yet because we're still pinning it down, but it will likely be the third week of May, and you can look on our calendar for more information about that.
All right, that's the blessing of the seeds, and then I know you come back and do another blessing for the harvest.
Thank you, Leslie. Yeah, I appreciate that. So there are. This is actually a program that runs from May through October, where the first program is the blessing of the seeds. The second program is really blessing a meal and a food, all kinds of foods to share. And then the third one is the harvest. La Milpa refers to the Three Sisters program. The Three Sisters kind of growing initiative that is very traditional among many cultures to grow corn, beans, and squash together, because those, they sort of repel pests. It's sort of a symbiotic process. The shade of the corn helps out the squash. So there's it's a wonderful growing kind of cultural history that we learn about in the course of those three programs from May through October.
Okay. I know another popular program is the dinners in the garden. You're still working on those dates?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Those are going to be coming up. I think I can almost announce our first one is going to be with Alpine Distilling, our very, very fabulous and favorite cocktail class. So, don't want to announce on the air before Sarah and I have tied off on that, but it will be also at the end of May. We're looking forward to a season of wonderful dinners with some of our favorite local chefs. We have some new chefs coming on as well. We're going to have a wonderful shade structure. It's an amazing place to gather for dinner with friends. There's, always cocktails, often music. So look forward to telling you more about that next time we're on. But also, again, I keep saying the website is a great way to get information. Also, you can join our mailing list or social media at Summit Community Gardens. Is a great way to stay connected to us online.
Okay, Melissa, any plots left for rent?
Unfortunately not.
Okay.
There are maybe a couple opportunities. We'll see folks that might not be able to participate this summer. So always best to get on the wait list, and I'll let folks know ahead of time, and then the process to secure those available plots. So there's always a couple that come up in the spring. So best to get on the wait list, and hopefully you'll get lucky.
Yeah, so what is it, like Father's Day before we actually get plants in the ground?
I would say not necessarily. I mean, if you're looking to transplant like your tomatoes, warmer season things, absolutely. But if you're thinking about colder season crops like snap peas or radishes, as soon as the ground is workable, we can get those in the soil. So I'm looking to do that probably by the end of this month, fingers crossed.
Okay, Helen, Melissa, thanks.